How did it come about? How did you suddenly decide to sort of do such a change? Because basically you were a comedian.
Well, I've done quite a few documentaries. And America's such a vast place. And one hears all the nasty side of America. You're always hearing about the crime rate and the color problem and drugs and everything else. But there is a part of America which is, to my mind, had never really been explored by any sort of television. They would go after the spectacular side of it. And I spent some time there wandering, and it is a very beautiful country, and it's very diverse. The northeast coast is totally different than the middle of the country, and the west coast is totally different again, and the people are very different. And it really is like Britain in many ways. It's a series of counties that really are, in their own way, countries. I mean, they have a different way of life. They speak a different language to the next state. Their musical choice, their social habits are different. And there's a great intermingling of European cultures, too. I mean, there's great areas where they're Dutch and German, and they've retained a lot of the qualities of cooking and the style of architecture. And it's... I find it a fascinating country.
The whole series is fascinating. Off stage, you know, behind the camera, the things that happened. Anything that in front of the camera, there were so many amazing things that you showed. But there must have been things behind the camera which we didn't see on television or hear about.
Very seldom. Normally, one looks at something when you're going to do it. You explore the whole technical side of it. And most of the people, well, I would think every one of them had no experience of television or cameras or anything. So you can't muddle them with technicalities. They don't understand why you've got to take a shot a second time and why you've got to do a shot over a shoulder or why, while you're talking about something, you have to go off and photograph something else. So one would just be very gentle with them and talk to them and let them talk, and normally it worked in one straight take.
What was the most exciting adventure in America?
Well, there was a couple of times that when I went up to Idaho to this man called Sylvan Hart, who turned his back on society and became a total recluse and found that he enjoyed nature so much. And he was totally dependent on himself. The only thing he took up there was some supplies, originally some coffee and some dried meat and beans and things, and tools. He said, you know, this is the most important thing. If you're going to live off the country, you have to first initially make somewhere to live, because you have to protect yourself. And then from there, I mean, everything he made then, whether it was his knives or his cups or his house or his bookshelves or whatever he ate, he totally took it from the countryside, and he made his own rifles and hand pistols. And then he would, he'd have this beautiful rifle. I mean, I said, how do you begin to make a rifle from having no knowledge of it? And he said, well, you start off by cutting down a tree. But to get in there, we had to take four different airplanes. We left San Francisco, and then we went to another place, and then we eventually got to a small town called Boise, and then we picked up a small four-seater airplane. That was the only way we could get into this place, and we had to land on what literally is a sandbar. It's 232 yards, and I know this because I asked the pilot how long the strip was, and he said it was 232 yards. And I said, how long do you take to stop in this? He said, 228. It was a fairly hair-raising, because you actually had to get down. There was no way that you could approach it because of the valley and the rocks and the mountains on the side. So one had to spiral in reverse down like a giant buzzard. It was the only way we could actually get down. And then when we got to the ground, Greg, our sound recorder, leapt out and kissed the ground with great love. And the man, the pilot, tapped him on the shoulder and says, don't you know I'm going to take you out tomorrow?
You can get out again.
You have to, we had to actually unload the plane totally. We went out in two sections. We couldn't take off with all the equipment. And we couldn't actually bring in a lot of equipment, but when we did leave, we had to go out in twos as opposed to coming in. We were all right. And I suppose, for me, there were some marvelous moments. I met some probably sixth, seventh generation mountain men, and they played their own music, and he made his own dulcimers and banjos. And I met his mother, and from the mother I met another old lady, which we didn't film, but I was just talking to her. And one never assumes, say, America as possibly a very having great poverty. And there are areas, or there were areas in America, which were extremely poverty-stricken, especially the mountain people. And she was telling me she was 11 years of age, the first time she saw an orange. And her brother had been to the big town nearby, which they had never seen, and he brought oranges, and they didn't even know what oranges were. And they thought they were rubber balls. And they were bouncing them, and they split. And even the mother had never seen an orange. And she said, they're obviously, the rubber hasn't set, so put them on the mantelpiece. And when the brother came back, they all said, you know, those balls you bought us are no good because they're all split. And he said, they're not, they're oranges. And I said, well, did you eat it? She said, yes, and I didn't like it. I've never liked oranges since then. And they do extraordinary things. I mean, they do their own dye. They make all their own dye from vegetable dyes. If they want green, they make cabbage. They take a dye from a cabbage. Some of them still make their own soap. They do a lot of their own weaving. And they make the most marvelous bedspreads, too, this Appalachian bedspread, which is it's just little squares, which they add on and add on. But they do the most marvelous patterns of... it could be a sunrise, or it could be just like looking at a series of mountains that disappear into perspective. But delightful and very lively people. I mean, I went to an old folks' place to try and find some old-timers with memories of... And I met one man who sadly was very, very deaf, but he was 101. But when they started playing the music, there was a group of musicians and fiddle and a couple of banjos, and he was off like a hare. I mean, he was dancing. I mean, he danced everybody into the ground.
Hardly.
And I suppose my favourite place was what was known as the Okefenokee Swamp.
Oh, yes.
Which was...
That's like the beginning of the world.
Yes. Mm. Well, that's what I, you know, if there was such a place as the Garden of Eden, I think that's probably... It's extraordinarily beautiful. And the stillness. And America is a very noisy country. Where there is noise, it's very noisy, and they speak loudly too. But this area was just the other way around. Everybody spoke in very quiet voices.
This is where you met the Swampies.
Yeah. Mm. And marvelous. I mean, lovely, lovely people.
Another facet of your character is religion. You know, we assume that you are a Roman Catholic, and every now and again you have a joke. About religion. can I ask, what are your views on religion?
My own personal views on religion, I believe totally in whatever a man wants to do. Whatever a man wants to do, whatever he wants to believe in, that's his right. I don't believe it's the right of any other man to crack him on the head and say, because he doesn't believe what I believe in, he's wrong. I do take the proverbial out of religion at times, because religion in its own way does need its pomposity pricked occasionally. Mm. And generally most of the criticism that I would get doesn't come from the church or church people. It comes from lay people. Mm. Many priests and vicars and rabbis, they fall about laughing. But at the same time, I actually just do it all with Roman Catholic. I mean, if one, you can, I always make sure that I have a various costumes, which would be strictly Roman Catholic one, but another one would be strictly Church of England, or High Church, or maybe it might be Buddhist, or whatever. So a lot of the gags are, I mean, the confessional gags obviously are Catholic, but a lot of the church stuff, I mean, even if I put a hymn board up, that signifies basically that it's not a Catholic church. And there are many ways, everybody, you know, or people think or assume that it's the Catholic church all the time, but I mean, I spread it about a bit.
Is this the first occasion you've actually been to Eastbourne, or have you been?
No, I filmed down here. We did some filming down here.
Oh, yes.
Did quite a lot of filming down here. We did, actually, I wrote a sketch called The Church Strike, where the priests went on strike for more money, and all the other denominations came out in support.
I remember this one, yes.
And then we had bits where there were strike breakers and blacklegs. And we did all that. We filmed all that around Eastbourne. It was quite extraordinary, actually, because we were walking up the road in this with a bishop and a rabbi and a Buddhist monk and Muslim high priest and all the various denominations that we could kind of, and we were walking up, and there was some nuns, there was some priests, I mean, they were all actors. And this clergyman came around the corner and saw us, and it was, you know, unite against, and we had all the banners and everything. And he took one look at us, because, I mean, he didn't know us from the hole of the ground. As far as he was concerned, I suppose it was a real group of people. So, and he just looked at us and ran around that corner.
Didn't try to join you.
No.
Would it be correct to say that you started the early part of your career at Butlins, because we had Roy Hudd on an earlier programme, and he of course mentioned you because you were there.
Yes, I met Roy. Roy was, excuse me, I'm looking for a cigarette. Roy was doing a double act when I met him. He was in Clacton and I was in Skegness, and I was going on to Brighton to the Saltine Hotel for the winter season. And I went to Clacton for 2 weeks to finish off the season there, because our camp had closed, and I met Roy. There was quite a lot of them, actually. It's Freddie Davis, Parrot Face Davis, Jimmy Tarbuck, Des O'Connor.
Was this before they were known, or this?
Yeah, they were all redcoats. It was all an early
ground.
It was a very good grounding, because at the time, you see, it was very difficult to get work. And you ran into this kind of chase your own tail syndrome, because you would go to an agent and say, look, I'm a comedian, and can you get me some work? And he said, well, I won't book you until I see you work. Where can you work? And you were saying, well, I can't work, because there's nowhere that'll take me. And Butlins actually was very good, because it gave you a chance to experiment, because the thing that you did have was an audience.
Yes.
And you could practice on them, learn from them.
Which was the point when you sort of reached stardom? What was it, the introduction to television?
I never look at the word as stardom. I don't like stardom. It seems to be separate. I mean, it looks like it's kind of cold and isolated and a star, so you know. Your career can take many patterns. I mean, it's... Television, I suppose, is the best way of getting known. Because if I'm in Eastbourne, I'm in Eastbourne. That's it. There's no way of the people in Glasgow knowing that I'm in Eastbourne. But if I'm on television, well, then that television breaks down all those distant barriers. I suppose, I suppose television actually is the easiest way of getting known.
When was it? What was the breakthrough?
There's many kind of shifts. I mean, I was working with Sophie Tucker, and she recommended to somebody in Australia me, and they wrote to me, and I went out there for basically a nightclub season of 8 weeks. And while I was there, I got offered an interview show, a chat show, or a pilot for a chat show. So, which I did this pilot, and they were quite happy with it, so I stayed on for nearly a year, or 8 months, doing this weekly show, which was basically very good, because it was a live show. It gave me a lot of confidence to ignore cameras, which is a very difficult thing to. And it also made me work, because I just didn't have to do one spot. and that was the end of it. I had to do a lot of little spots, and I had to kind of keep on thinking about material and writing and rewriting. And I was doing one a week, so it was good for me.
You write all your own material?
I would write, for television, I would write probably 75% of it. For the theatre or the nightclub floor, I would write the majority of it. You just occasionally need somebody else to help you out.
I know you've got to go on stage in a minute, so we've got to watch the time. Finally, what's the future? What does it hold for you? What can we
hear? If I knew that, I would play God. I've no idea.
Nothing planned at the moment.
No, I don't particularly like to plan things too much, because I like the surprise of life. I mean, if I had to think, oh my God, next year I've got all that booked up, and just by chance something comes up which I really want to do, then I could never do it. Because of preparing my life ahead. I don't really like to be more than a couple of months ahead of myself.
Dave Allen, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.